genocidal war on Gaza as the regime continues to pound the blockaded territory with air and artillery strikes. The regime's fresh attacks have killed at least 11 Palestinians since the early hours of the morning. The targeted areas include Jabalia in the north and a neighborhood near the southern city of Rafah. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, over 60 Palestinians were killed and nearly 360 injured in the Tuesday strikes. The new fatalities bring the death toll from Israel's renewed aggression on Gaza since March 18th to nearly 800. The overall death toll from the regime's genocide since October 2023 now stands at over 50,140, with more than 113,700 injured. Gaza's health ministry warns that Israel is enforcing a policy of slowly killing Palestinians by blocking the entry of aid, including fuel and medical supplies, into the territory. The ministry added that Gaza is facing severe shortages of fuel and essential medical supplies, including gauze and oxygen tanks. It noted that there is only one operational power generator at the Indonesian hospital, where 7 intensive care patients are at risk if the generator fails. The ministry stressed that the lack of medicine for chronic illnesses such as hypertension and diabetes is leading to more deaths in Gaza. It described Israel's war on Gaza as a war of annihilation, adding that the current state of the territory's health sector is beyond catastrophic. The Israeli military presses ahead with incursions into towns and refugee camps in the occupied West Bank. In Beit Lahem, the regime's troops raided Palestinian homes and abducted several of their residents. They've also raided the Balata refugee camp near Nablus and several other camps across the territory. We earlier joined by our Ramallah correspondent Nara Hamed to get further details regarding the latest raids. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
The situation over here in the West Bank, as you have described, many incursions, many attacks, and the IOF is continuously moving forward, pushing more military force inside the West Bank, the cities of the West Bank. Last night was an extreme tensive last night in the area of Ash-Sharqawi in Jenin, where violent raids and clashes happened between the raiding IOF forces to the area and Palestinian resistant fighters. This incursion has led to many arrests among the Palestinians, including Uday al-Ba'jawi, one of the leaders of the Jenin battalion and one of the most wanted Palestinian freedom fighter or resistant fighter over here in the West Bank. He has been persuaded for 3 years now. The IOF was looking for him and tracking him down for 3 years. Last night, unfortunately, he was captured by the IOF forces in the area of Al-Ba'jawi after violent clashes between him and between the IOF forces in that area. Not only that was the unfortunate event in Jenin last night, but also that the IOF is now preparing themselves to demolish more than 90 homes inside Jenin's refugee camp.
We've been reporting Israel's detention of an Oscar-winning Palestinian filmmaker for almost 24 hours after he was attacked by Israeli settlers and soldiers in the West Bank. The filmmaker Hamdan Bilal now says that the goal of the attack was to kill him.
It was a very strong attack, and the goal was to kill. After I won the Oscar, I did not expect attacks. I thought that after the Oscars, the attacks became more focused on us and a threat to our lives in the future. An Israeli settler turned around and hit me on the head with the first punch. Of course, he was hitting me all over my body, and there was also a soldier with him hitting me. There are army shifts that change. They change. We hear the sound and we know that someone is changing. They were talking about this guy who won the Oscar. I don't know Hebrew, but I hear my name Hamdan, and I understand that they are talking about the film.
Bilal added that the regime's troops then began threatening, brandishing weapons, and using foul language against him. Upon his release, Bilal said that he was kept blindfolded in Israeli detention. The Palestinian director was beaten and then detained in the village of Susia on Monday. The Oscar-winning documentary named No Other Land, that he co-directed with several other filmmakers, explores the struggles of living under Israeli occupation. and a press conference has been held in the Russian capital Moscow on Tuesday. It was dedicated to International Quds Day that will be marked this coming Friday in a show of solidarity with the Palestinian people. Marina Kartunova has been at the presser and sent us this report.
Iranian and Palestinian ambassadors to Russia have attended a press conference in Moscow, which was held ahead of International Quds Day. According to the Palestinian ambassador, five more European countries, including Spain, Belgium, Ireland, Norway, and Slovenia, have recently recognized the state of Palestine.
Many countries are already boycotting Israeli products, and Palestine is calling on other countries to follow suit. Some countries, such as Ireland, are taking a bold and decisive stance. We are seeing changes in the mood of European parliaments in Italy, Brussels, and elsewhere. Even in the US, there are shifts, although it will take time.
Nafal spoke of the need for a new world order in which Russia and China would play a more significant role.
We need a new world order based on justice and freedom. What has been happening in Gaza for 17 months is one-sided aggression. Where is the peace? Where is the international community? Where is freedom and justice? We call for actions that will lead to real change and justice for all.
Iran's ambassador to Moscow emphasized the importance of solidarity with the Palestinian people at a time when Israeli crimes against them have reached an unprecedented level. Kazem Jalali also said that the ongoing resistance in different areas of the West Asia region is spontaneous.
It was the occupation that shaped the resistance in the region. The West claim that resistance groups or proxies of Iran is being raised with the aim of erasing the resistance. As Iran's leader pointed out, using proxy for resistance groups is a completely incorrect term. Attributing this claim to our country is due to the anger of the Israeli regime.
International Quds Day is an annual event marked on the last Friday of the Muslim holy months of Ramadan. On this day, people hold rallies across the world in a show of solidarity with the Palestinian people who live under Israeli occupation. This year's rallies are significant as Israel has intensified its aggression against Palestinians both in Gaza and the occupied West Bank.
Commemorating Al-Quds Day is even more important today as Israel pushes with its plot to kill or expel Palestinians and extend its occupation on the Gaza Strip. Al-Quds Day is a reminder for all freedom seekers of the world who stand against any oppressions to establish justice. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Israeli military's incursion and deadly attack in Syria's Daraa province on Tuesday have forced Syrian residents there to leave their homes. Video shows that women, children, and the elderly are among the Syrians leaving the town of Koya. The displacement comes as Israeli artillery shelling killed at least seven Syrian people in Koya. The attack took place after Israeli forces staged an incursion there. The incursion was met with resistance by the Syrian people in the area. The Israeli military has been carrying out air raids and ground incursions into Syria in an attempt to rob the country of its military capabilities. The number of the strikes has multiplied since the overthrow of Syria's former government in December and the takeover by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham militants. The Yemeni armed forces have carried out fresh anti-U.S. and anti-Israel operations as the Arab country remains the supporter of Palestine amid the ongoing Gaza genocide.
The missile, UAV, and the naval forces carried out a joint military operation targeting enemy warships in the Red Sea, led by the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Harry Truman, from which the aggression against our country is launched.
Saadi said the attack on U.S. warships was in response to the American aggression against Yemen. He said the Yemeni armed forces also struck Israeli military targets in the occupied Yafa area, with a number of drones, adding that the operation successfully achieved its objectives. The spokesman reiterated that the attack on Israeli targets will not come to an end until the aggression on Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. The operations come as U.S. military continues to pound areas across Yemen. According to Yemeni media, U.S. warplanes bombed the northwestern province of Sa'ada for nearly 20 times in a matter of hours. Moving on, it's been nearly a decade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its military campaign in Yemen with U.S. support, which started as an attempt to reinstate former President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi turned into one of the world's most devastating conflicts. Now, years after a ceasefire was reached, Yemenis are still grappling with the aftermath. Abdul Latif al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
March 25th, 2015, the day when the Saudi-led coalition launched a military campaign in Yemen to reinstate former President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, an ally of Saudi Arabia. The campaign aimed to push the Ansarullah movement back to Sada'a in northern Yemen as well. With support from the United States, the coalition also sought to establish a buffer zone between Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
When the Saudi-led aggression against the Yemeni people began in 2015, it had no clear objectives. However, when the aggressors realized they were entangled in this war, they declared an official goal through a meeting at the United Nations Security Council and Resolution 2216, which was to reinstate Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi to power. Yet they failed to achieve this goal, along with all the objectives they had set for their coalition.
The United Nations estimates that the war in Yemen has killed 337,000 people by the end of 2021. The deaths include those caused by both conflict and indirect causes, such as hunger and preventable diseases. According to UN officials, the indirect causes were to blame for the majority of the deaths, as the Saudi-led coalition maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen, a country dependent on international aid to meet its basic needs, even prior to the war.
As the 10th anniversary of the aggression against Yemen arrives, the blockade continues to severely impact the healthcare sector, causing immense suffering due to the ongoing restrictions on medical supplies. During the years of aggression, airstrikes have targeted 55% of the healthcare sector, rendering 98% of medical equipment non-operational, as we have been unable to repair them or secure spare parts.
The years-long war also devastated other key infrastructure, including airports. The airstrikes, coupled with the crippling blockade, created what the United Nations called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, leaving millions struggling for basic necessities.
There have been many tragedies over the past 10 years of the blockade, both in humanitarian terms and in material losses. On the humanitarian side, there have been significant losses of lives, especially among patients with critical illnesses who needed to travel for treatment but were prevented due to the airport closure. In addition, many students were unable to continue their studies, and tourism came to a complete halt, inflicting severe losses on the national economy.
Archaeological sites were not safe from attacks either. According to a 2019 report by the UN's cultural agency UNESCO, Yemeni cultural heritage sites were heavily affected, mostly through collateral damage. Following years of deaths and destruction, a ceasefire was agreed on April 2, 2022, under UN sponsorship. But while the fighting has largely stopped, Yemen's economic crisis continues, and the struggle to rebuild remains an uphill battle.
Even with a ceasefire in place, the scars of war are still visible across Yemen. Families who lost everything now face the challenge of rebuilding their lives amid an economic crisis. For many Yemenis, the road to recovery is far from over. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has unveiled another underground facility housing hundreds of domestically built precision strike missiles. According to the IRGC, the new underground facility is among hundreds of missile cities built across the Iranian territory by its aerospace division. The facility houses various types of precision strike ballistic and cruise missiles, including Khaybar Shikan, Imad, Sejil, and Qadr H. Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, paid a visit to the facility along with the commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh. He described the facility as evidence to the armed forces' determination to continue to grow, advance, and enhance their capabilities. The new facility was unveiled less than a week after the IRGC revealed three underground hangars on three Iranian islands of Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa in the Persian Gulf. They also house advanced cruise missiles capable of striking naval targets at a distance of up to 600 kilometers from their base. In Turkey, demonstrations against the detention of former Istanbul mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu continue unabated as thousands return to the city streets. Thousands of university students flooded a major district in Istanbul heading for the municipal headquarters. They demanded resignation of the government while waving flags and banners. People in nearby buildings bashed pots to show their solidarity with protesters. A new demonstration came after a court in Istanbul jailed 7 journalists for covering the protests. Separately, thousands also rallied for the 8th straight night in a protest organized by İmamoğlu's Republican People's Party, or the CHP. The leader of the opposition party has called for mass rallies over the weekend to protest the arrest of İmamoğlu, demand open trials, and call for early elections. The call for the Saturday rally comes as almost 1,500 people have already been arrested. İmamoğlu, a politician from the CHP, was seen as the main rival to the incumbent Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for the next presidential election slated for 2028. That brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Thanks for tuning in.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
In the limelight.
Technology billionaire Elon Musk has lashed out at U.S. judges as they rule against his Department of Government Efficiency. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. In the days after a federal judge ruled Elon Musk's dismantling of US aid likely violated the Constitution, the world's richest person issued a series of online attacks against the American judiciary, offered money to voters to sign a petition opposing activist judges, and called on Congress to remove his newfound legal opponents from office. Elon Musk wrote on Wednesday, 19th of March, "This is a judicial coup," and he asked lawmakers to impeach the judges. Elon Musk, who serves as a senior advisor to Donald Trump, posted about judges who ruled in opposition to the administration more than 20 times within 48 hours this week on X, the social network that he owns. He repeatedly framed them as radical leftist activists, and he sought to undermine their authority. His denunciations came as his so-called Department of Government Efficiency faces sweeping and numerous legal challenges to its gutting overhaul of the government, which has involved firing thousands of government workers and gaining access to sensitive government data. The Department of Government Efficiency is a subject of nearly 24 lawsuits, which in some cases have already resulted in judges imposing more transparency on Elon Musk's initiative or reversing parts of its rapid fire cuts at federal agencies. The legal pushback poses one of the most significant challenges to Elon Musk's plans, which for weeks after Inauguration Day involved operating with expansive powers and little evident oversight. While Musk posts online, he is also directing some of his immense wealth towards those who support his cause. Musk donated funds to 7 Republican members of Congress who called for impeaching judges, the New York Times reported, giving the maximum allowable donation of $6,600 to their campaigns. Elon Musk also launched a petition on Thursday, 20th of March, against activist judges via his political action group, America PAC, which offered registered voters in Wisconsin $100 if they signed. Elon Musk's America PAC has funneled millions of dollars into the state's 1st of April Supreme Court race, in which he's backing a former Republican attorney general in another attempt to reshape the country's courts. Elon Musk's campaign against judges has intensified amid a wider clash between the Trump administration and the judiciary over the rule of law, following court decisions who push back against the administration's mass deportations of immigrants. It follows long-standing behavior from Donald Trump to rail against judges that have ruled against him in cases concerning his businesses or personal matters. The White House's fight with judges escalated to the point where John Roberts, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, issued a rare public statement on Tuesday defending America's judicial system. John Roberts wrote, "For more than 2 centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate process exists for that purpose." Elon Musk, however, responded to John Roberts in a post on X, formerly known as Twitter, just one day later. Elon Musk wrote, "For more than 2 centuries, there has never been such extreme abuse of the legal system by activists pretending to be judges. Impeach them." Labor groups, watchdog organizations, and former government workers have filed lawsuits in response to the Department of Government Efficiency's blitz through federal agencies in late January and February, alleging that Elon Musk's initiative acted without legal authority and violated laws on privacy and transparency. Although the justice system's response is not as rapid as the breakneck pace of Department of Government Efficiency's cuts, several of the cases against Elon Musk's efforts are now beginning to throw up roadblocks for him and his team. A federal judge in Maryland ruled on Tuesday that Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency's shutdown of USAID, the agency that provided humanitarian aid and one of the first in Elon Musk's crosshairs, was likely unconstitutional. The justice ordered the Trump administration to halt terminations of employees and reinstate their access to certain computer systems. Department of Government Efficiency had dramatically taken over the agency in early February and moved to close its operations, which Elon Musk boasted involved feeding U.S. aid into the wood chipper. Judge Theodore Chuang found that Elon Musk's actions at the agency likely violated the Constitution, given his role as an unelected advisor who did not undergo Senate confirmation. Department of Government Efficiency faced another setback on Thursday as a different Maryland District Court judge temporarily blocked Elon Musk's team from accessing Social Security Administration systems. A lawsuit against Department of Government Efficiency argued that granting access to millions of people's personal data at the agency violates privacy laws and represents a security threat. Another district court ruling last week ordered the Trump administration to reinstate probationary workers who were fired en masse at 18 government agencies, while a separate case compelled Elon Musk's team to produce internal records about its staff and operations. As Elon Musk and Donald Trump officials have ramped up their attacks on judges, multiple justices told Reuters news agency earlier this month that U.S. marshals warned them they are facing unusually high threat levels against their personal safety. Elon Musk has reacted to the court decisions with outrage and unsubstantiated accusations that the judges are rogue activists who must be stopped. On X, the Tesla CEO has amplified far-right influencers who have called for impeaching justices or targeted specific judges in posts. An activist judge is no judge at all, just someone wearing a costume, Elon Musk responded to a post from right-wing commentator Matt Walsh that suggested Donald Trump should go to war against activist judges. Elon Musk has also received support from foreign leaders who have attacked their country's judiciaries and challenged the rule of law. He responded with a 100 emoji to a post from the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that claimed when a strong right-wing leader wins an election, the leftist deep state weaponizes the justice system. Benjamin Netanyahu attempted in 2023 to weaken the power of Israel's judiciary, prompting nationwide protests and fears of a constitutional crisis. El Salvador, where President Nayib Bukele's party ousted all Supreme Court judges in 2021 as human rights groups warned about a slide into authoritarianism, has become a repeated point of comparison for Elon Musk. He retweeted a post from President Bukele on Tuesday that claimed the U.S. is facing a judicial coup and repeated that language himself in later posts on X.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Good evening. Child killer is probably the first word that comes into mind when one hears of Israel. Since October 2023, Palestinian children have been bearing the brunt of the genocidal war waged on the besieged strip with US military support. Now, a non-governmental organization says more than 270 kids have lost their lives since the genocide was reignited against Palestinians some days ago. It also says and warns that the resumption of the war amounts to death sentence for Gaza's children. In tonight's Spotlight, we'll be discussing the impacts of Israel's offensive on children amid the regime's blocking of humanitarian aid into the war-ravaged Gaza. I am Bahman Nouray, your host. Allow me to introduce my guests. Batrul Sobeiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Saeb Shahab, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast. Welcome to the programme. I'm going to start with you, Saeb. Very good to have you once again on Spotlight. We have a lot of reports. We have a lot of condemnations coming from different international organisations against the brutal aggression of the Israeli regime against the children of Gaza. But at the same time, no feasible action has been taken. What's the reason?
All of these organizations and the international community, quote unquote, as they say, and it's non-state actors or multinational organization, all controlled by the Western ruling elite led by the United States of America. And these guys, since the British occupation of Palestine in 1917, at the time of the League of the Nation and then United Nation, they geared up to put in Palestine the population which they don't want in Europe, the Jewish population. They are anti-Semitic, they want to cleanse them from Europe, and they want to put them in Palestine, a population in top of a indigenous population. That means genocide in simple terms. This is all along. The British in 1947 handed its mandate to Palestine to the Americans, and the Americans carried on the old partition of Palestine and support of this Zionist entity to make it the monster we see today, and with impunity, which is any United Nations resolution, which is there is over 70 United Nations resolution, including General Security Council and the Assembly against the Zionist entity. They didn't even commit themselves to one. And we remember one resolution of Security United Nations Security Council against Iraq. Iraq was destroyed, and more than 2 million people lost in Iraq because of that. But the Zionist entity being all along as an advanced military base to the West. And this is the way and we should look at it. It's part of the almighty armada of the United States of America. And they permitted to cleanse Palestine. And they are, since 1917 till today, through even 1948, when they commit the Nakba, they're trying to commit the Nakba on Palestine by eliminating any sort of life in Palestine, keeping erasing the population to get rid of the population out of Palestine. This is the target, and this is why you can see all along before the genocide in Gaza now, the Western media were the Zionist entity, its darling, and they were always producing the best images and the best stories accompanying that, even trying to cover up and whitewash today's the genocide. So all tools of the West are geared up to protect the Zionist entity and to provide it with immunity against the international community. And that is the main reason.
Now, before Batul joins us, tell me why there is no measure taken, no specific measure taken to stop this war machine against the children. Because, as you said, a lot of the countries are taking sides, said or unspoken, that they're taking sides with the Israeli regime in the collective West. But at the same time, they can be firm in their condemnation of killing children. But they do not do that. The silence sometimes amounts to indifference. What needs to be done in order to make a difference?
The silence is deafening, to put it that way. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, has confirmed that the Zionist occupation airstrikes killed over 200 children in Gaza in just a few days. And all along, the Zionist entity, we can see them if you look back, they are targeting the Palestinian children with intent to kill or to disable, or put it differently, with the phrase they use, to neutralize. You're talking about a child. During the first Intifada, 1987, a Swedish TV crew caught live on camera a group of soldiers breaking the arms and limbs of Palestinian children, even the age of 7 and 8, with large rocks. And the army commander who was responsible for that atrocity in the year 2002 replaced the former Prime Minister Yehuda Barak and became the leader of the Labour lefty Zionist Labour Party. So all the political spectrum of the Zionist entity, Likud, Labour, left, right, are committed to the policy of destroying the indigenous Palestinian people. And many of children, we were being even shot and even kidnapped by soldiers for organ harvest. During the 2018 Gaza Great Return March, which is used to happen the weekend every week, peaceful protest, and you can see so many injuries from the Zionist entity snipers, the soldiers, targeting the kids and just causing them death or disabilities, life-changing disabilities.
Right, so I'm as Batul has now joined us. Very good to have you on the program, Batul. I'm going to talk about the effects of war and this Israeli war machine on against the children on that mental health. This is a really important issue. The collective West, the international community in its totality, seems to be very sensitive, or at least pretends to be very sensitive when it comes to women's rights and children's rights. But how come when it comes to the children of Gaza, the women of Gaza, they seem to be really not caring?
Of course, that is because international law does not apply to the Israeli occupation entity that has been given immunity from all kinds of criticism. And that's something that they've even sought to embed within the law itself. So for example, you know, the whole conflation of anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism in order to protect the occupation entity has become this untouchable entity that you are not allowed to, even on the level of criticize. And that's because we know that Israel is America's pet project, and it is protected by it unconditionally. And as your guest has alluded to, what on earth has the UN done to stop this genocide? But ultimately, these past 10 months have shown the dirty face of the capitalist structure that is ruling the world, and I think has really removed the masks of deception, because such a scale of atrocity has not happened since World War II. Where you had all of these conventions and all of these agreements to prevent such a genocide from happening. And that's shown to be complete lies in front of the real test that we are now seeing materially on the ground. But of course, the mass people are waking up to the realities on the ground, because the mass people now use social media and they're seeing the footage for themselves of charred babies, of babies that are completely burnt. You know, 6 months into this war, and the statistics were that 1 in 50 of Gaza's children are killed or injured. Children are, let's be clear, intentional targets of the Israeli occupation entity. It's not normal for 70% of those killed to be women and children. And that's because Israel's plan for the Palestinians is ethnic cleansing. The war is not against the Gazan resistance per se. It's against the collective Palestinian people, because the people themselves are the resistance. Just identifying as a Palestinian, you are condemned to death, because the contention of the Israeli occupation entity is with the entire existence of the Palestinian people. But by targeting specifically the Palestinian children, they are targeting what is effectively the most precious thing to the mothers of Gaza, to the families. And so what they seek to do is they seek to create defeatism through targeting what they consider to be the weakest and the most kind of emotional point in all of this, and that is the children. But what does this do to the psychology of the children is the question that you've asked. Children are so innate. They're so pure in their disposition. Children reject evil. What is there that the children of Gaza haven't seen? In terms of charred bodies, limbs everywhere. I mean, the children of Gaza can probably identify what bombs are falling just from the sound that they make. So these children that are smelling death everywhere, that's become their common sense. That's become their new normal, just witnessing death. These children will grow up and they will seek justice. So expect that it is this very generation of children that will liberate Palestine. The genocide was just the catalyst or the recruiter for this, if you will, but it's reaffirmed everything for these children about the nature of their enemy that they knew prior to the genocide. Because also, let's be clear that prior to the genocide, the children in Gaza were living under exceptionally poor mental health due to the very poor quality of life that was imposed by the blockade, which the UN literally described as an open air prison. You know, this was prior to October the 7th. Families and friends that are completely separated from one another, complete restriction on movement, complete restriction on access to essential services. They had absolutely no bare minimum quality of life.
right, Saib, as Batul just said, regarding what she said about the ethnic cleansing, we have footage from Gaza where you can, and the West Bank, of course, where you can see that the Israeli soldiers are even more persistent in targeting, with their snipers, targeting children and women rather than the grown-up men. They know that this is going to be like planting the seeds of anger and vengeance in that territory. Why are they still so committed to doing that? Are they feeding off the tragedy?
All along, they wanted to create what they call it, something they call the Netanyahu lately, talking about existential threat for their nation and the total victory. Total victory, it means from the even the 50s, 60s, they've been talking about this, to implant in the Palestinian psyche that they are a defeated nation. So a defeated nation will act in the land as enslaved people, or leave or die, as they said with the statement lately after the October the 7th, with intent to genocide to the Palestinian people, to accept to be enslaved or to die or to leave. This all along they've been repeated that in a report of the Amnesty International in December last year. They concluded Israel's intent is the physical destruction of the Palestinian people in Gaza. So their genocide campaign is target the Palestinian people. They can cover that up by saying they are looking at a military target within a United Nations compound or something. These lies nobody believes, but the United States of America and the West wanted anything so they can toss at their own people and keep going the genocide, because the intention is to cleanse all the Palestinian out of Palestine. Trump himself, before he was elected, said Israel is tiny. What today we see? We see today Israel expanding in the south of Lebanon. Today took nearly a quarter of the size of Syria from the Golan Heights and Yarmouk and Dar'a and the Jabal al-Sheikh Mount Hiron. And they are planning to extend to reach Euphrates River near Iraq. So all of that is done with policies designed and supported by the United States of America's politicians and the state as a whole, or Democrat or Republican. This is built within the whole entity of the United States of America. So this is part of why the genocide came in. There is a United Nations inquiry 10 days ago talking about the genocide and the genocidal acts and humanitarian violations committed by the Zionist entity in Gaza against women and against the productive services, reproductive services of the hospitals, and how to eliminate the ability of the Palestinian women and girls to be healthy and to destroy in the future any hope for the Palestinian to even to be able to give birth. This is part of the United Nations investigation. And if you want to hear the crimes committed against the children who they kidnap and imprison in there, they've been raped. Before the October the 7th, there was a report which is confirming for the international community the rape of the children in the prisons. And before, and they were denying it, but they buried it, and they buried all of these reports after the October the 7th. And there is a lot of witnesses, eyewitnesses can tell you, and they give testaments to what happened to the children in jails. Some children disappeared, forced disappeared, children dies, right. Children came mentally disturbed or physically disabled.
Right, Batul, I'm going to borrow the concept of destruction that Saib just mentioned, and I'm going to expand it to psychological side and effects of it. Do you think that by physically removing Palestinian homes, they're trying to deconstruct the concept of home and homeland in the mindset of the children in Gaza?
Oh, absolutely. That's essentially the foundations of the Israeli occupation entity. That is stealing the homes of the Palestinians and stealing the very land of the Palestinians. And we know that Netanyahu's strategy right now, through continuing this war in these past 18 months, has been also to create the most unbearable conditions for the Palestinian families to basically force them to mass migrate, to facilitate the depopulation plan that cannot be achieved by forceful means. The Palestinians have to want to leave, essentially. So they want to create the conditions so that they can encourage that mass movement and allow for a second Nakba to continue. There's no other solution the Israeli occupation entity is willing to accept. There's no concept of a two-state, it doesn't exist. One state, it cannot see Palestinians as humans, they're human animals as far as they're concerned, and it cannot re-besiege Gaza and re-control Gaza with the Gazan resistance standing strong there today. So inflicting mass destruction that we've seen, where 1.9 million out of the 2.2 million Gazans have been intentionally displaced because their homes have completely been destroyed. You know, that level of intent when it comes to mass destruction, that's not a sign of strength. That's a sign that you can't achieve anything using less destruction. So mass destruction is all that you can resort to. It means that you cannot achieve anything through political or through logical means. But this approach has proven futile with the Palestinians because they have constantly rejected displacement and they have ultimately remained steadfast in their land. But if we see Israel's strategy right now, it's not just the destruction of homes. All of Gaza is rubble. That includes schools that have been relentlessly bombed, the bakeries and the stores. So there's a lack of food, clean water, which is also creating a catastrophic hunger crisis where nearly every child now in Gaza is at risk of complete famine and dying from malnutrition and dehydration, compounded by the fact that they're completely cut off medical services, whether that's hospitals or whether that's even the medicine required to treat, you know, very simple illnesses and diseases. You know, compounded with the fact that 90% of the school buildings are completely damaged and destroyed, so there's no sense of the children of Gaza having normalcy going to school. You know, you hear that is usually one of the top priorities of the children that are interviewed in Gaza. What do you wish for? I wish that I can just go to school. I wish that I can just have my books. I wish that I can just play. You know, the children of Gaza have no escape from the reality of war. They have no stable routine. And of course, for many of them, for the vast majority of them, they have no family as well. And these are essentially the protective factors that allow the children to grow up well and healthy. But despite all of this, I just want to end this point by saying, we also see the footage of resilience that is coming out from Gaza. It's really unlike anything else. It's really miraculous. I don't think we've seen this anywhere else in the world. In terms of, you know, the children setting up schools, you know, school lessons on top of rubbles. We see the recitation, for example, of the Holy Quran in its entirety. You see that the children of Gaza are making use of the very little that they have materially. And this is, it is ultimately this spirit today that is fighting the enemy tanks. And it is this spirit that will prevail. So yes, materially speaking, we see nothing but destruction. But in reality, the Gazans have won because their morale has not been defeated, their resilience has not been defeated. And that is the most important component in all of this, because this is ultimately a war of morale. And if you fail to weaken the morale of the people, otherwise right. We would have seen the mass migration of the Palestinians and we would have seen Gaza being taken over by Israel.
Right, Petal, as you just said, miraculous is the word in describing what we are witnessing in Gaza. Now, Saeb, what do you think should be done by the international community to undo what the atrocious acts of the Israeli regime is doing to the community in Gaza?
Allow me to show you this, if you can see it. Can you see that child?
Yes, of course, yeah.
Yeah, that child is my cousin's daughter. She was killed 2 days ago near the United Nations barracks Rafah, while they are being evicted. Her name is Mira. She's 4 years of age. And what can imagine her parents, both of them were injured, and the child lost her life straight on the spot. Children cannot sustain injuries from a blast like adults because their bodies are tiny and they have less blood in their body. So they straight away die from these such injuries. The children of Gaza are targeted. The children of Gaza, they are the number one victim, and then the women and the Zionist entity's designs. So when you see a child like that, you relate to, and you know, it makes the pictures more vivid, more clear. As my colleague, what she's saying, I second that 100%. She's right. But at the same time, the international community are watching, and they are since 17 months or 16 and a half months now, they doing at all nothing at all to help the Palestinian people. The Islamic Cooperation Council doing nothing. The Arabic League doing nothing. Except the only people who's doing is the resistance axis, like Yemen and Iran and Lebanese resistance. This is the only people who's helping the Palestinians. But apart from that, there is no one taking the noble position of supporting the Palestinian and demanding a stop for such genocide. Because till now, over 3.5% of the population of Gaza been wiped out or injured, and you took this percentage and compare it to any country in the world, United States of America, you're talking about millions or different country. So in here, we call on humanity and all the international actors, state actors or non-state actors, to stop this maniacs, Zionist, fascist, Nazist entity from keep committing genocide against people. And trust me, all of that can stop with one phone call from Trump to Netanyahu.
Thank you so much once again, both of you. Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London, and Saeb Shah, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast. Once again, Saeb, I'm really sorry for the loss in your family. Once again, this is a loss for the entire humanity. And thank you, our audience, for staying with us on another Spotlight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن
Allah
هو إذا المنان
لا إله إلا. Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs with me, Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Ahmad Danish from the Islamic House of Qom is here to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
All right, Sheikh Ahmad Danish, today's question asks regarding the Battle of Nahrawan, which took place in 38 Hijra in the months of Safar between the army of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Khawarij. First of all, give us some details about the background of this battle, why this battle took place, and then there were some predictions or future tellings made by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam about the main result of this a battle which came true, and right. This had shown the divine knowledge of Imam Ali alayhi salam. First of all, give us the historical background. Why this battle took place between Imam Ali and Kharijites?
Right. So So the Khawarij were a special group of people who were earlier in the Battle of Siffin, which was fought against Muawiyah, who was the ruler or the governor of Syria, and who had not attested to the caliphate of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so there was a war that was fought with Muawiyah and his forces, the Syrian forces. And this battle got prolonged in such a way that a person was decided from the camp of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and a person was chosen from the camp of Muawiyah to decide about the future of this conflict. Because as we know that the famous incident of having the Holy Quran on the lenses, when it came about, some people said that we cannot fight with the Holy Quran. And it was basically a trick or treachery of the...
Made by Amr al-As.
Yes, made by Amr al-As.
The counselor Muawiyah, that's
yes.
Right.
And so many people who were ordinary Muslims, they thought that now they are inviting us to decide on the basis of the Holy Quran. So they mean good, and we should not kill other Muslims. So because of their, I would say, not seeing through the tricks of the opposite camp, they said that, no, we are not going to fight with these forces. So from... the camp of Imam Ali alayhi salam, they themselves chose Abu Musa al-Ash'ari.
Yes.
And we know that Abu Musa al-Ash'ari was a person who had, who was easily convinced by Amr al-As.
Yes.
And he said that I am going to decide that Imam Ali alayhi salam is not going to remain the caliph. And it was decided that Amr al-As would also say the same thing.
For Muawiyah.
And yes, for Muawiyah, but Amr al-As said that, and I have decided to place Muawiyah as the caliph. And so...
So it tricked him.
What?
Deceived him.
Deceived Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. Okay. And we had
it
always...
It was a Hakamiya one.
Yes,
right.
And this was the Jarian of Hakamiya.
Yes.
And when the Khawarij, or this group of ordinary, simple Muslims who might be very good in their prayers and everything, but who had no basira or who had no foresight, when they saw this affair, they said to Imam Ali alayhi salam that we must repent for the mistake that we have done. We have all turned into unbelievers. And now, Zubillah, you, Imam Ali alayhi salam, you also should repent and say that now you are going again in the fold of Islam. And this was something that Imam Ali said that no, he could not accept this, because this Hakamiya was imposed upon Imam Ali alayhi salam by these same simple Muslims who had no basira, who had no foresight.
Yes.
And he never gave his rizaya or his permission to Hakamiya.
Mm-hmm.
But he was forced into this Hakamiya.
That's right.
And he always believed that we should fight with the forces of Muawiyah, and unless and until we reach a victory on the battlefields,
okay,
Hakamiya would not have any purpose.
Right. Okay.
But the situation came to such a point that Imam Ali alayhi salam was about to be killed by these same people. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam had to stop fighting and to call back his commander-in-chief, Hazrat Malik Ashtar.
Malik Ashtar, that's right.
Yeah. So he had to call back his commander-in-chief, Malik Ashtar, who was very close to the camp of Muawiyah, and he was close to the to defeating him.
As he himself said, one sword a strike to demolish the camp of Batil.
Yes. Okay. Yes, and but Imam Ali had to bring him back, because these people had revolted,
mm-hmm,
and they could have killed Imam Ali alayhi salam.
So these were the same people that Imam Ali alayhi salam had the fight with, isn't it?
Yes. And so these people, after the
were excluding themselves.
Yes. After the Hakamiya event, they said that we have all become unbelievers,
mm-hmm,
and so we must repent and again come in the fold of Islam. And everyone who doesn't repent and come in the fold of Islam is a kafir, is an unbeliever, and wajibul qatl, for example. And we can fight with
that. That's why they call themselves khawarij, or
that,
we call them...
That is why we call them khawarij.
They, we can't say they were out of now.
They went out of the fold of Islam. Or, for example, they rebelled against the just leader of the community, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and... did khuruj on the just leader of the community.
Okay.
And so Imam Ali alayhi salam did not want to fight with the Khawarij at first. But when they started to plunder the wealth of ordinary Muslims, when they started to loot and plunder and kill ordinary Muslims, Imam Ali alayhi salam was forced to first tackle the Khawarij at the Battle of Nehrawan.